Hey everybody, welcome back to Cold Case Murder Mysteries. I'm your host Ryan Krause, coming at you once again from the dark depths of the true crime underworld to analyze the psychology present in the 2002 murders of Lacey Peterson and her unborn son Connor, who disappeared from the family's Modesto, California home on the morning of December 24th, 2002, leaving Lacey's husband Scott Peterson as the prime suspect in an overnight media sensation. But first, a bit of business to discuss. For those who are new to the podcast and tuning in for this bonus episode, Cold Case Murder Mysteries is currently available only by premium subscription on my website at coldcasemurdermysteries.com. So be sure to head on over and check it out. For iPhone users, you can download the show's new app on your device for free in the App Store today. And the Android app is in progress. I'll update you on its availability in the near future. Also, a few more things to mention here. Your 5-star ratings and reviews on Apple Podcasts are greatly appreciated, in addition to, and especially, monetary donations of any kind. It helps me to be able to drop an episode in my public feed from time to time, and I'm a big believer in podcasters being compensated for their efforts. So if you're inclined to do so, you can donate directly at coldcasemurdermysteries.com. Just look for the donate button in the middle of the page. The show is also on Patreon, if you'd prefer to contribute that way. Finally, I want to say a huge thank you to all of my paid subscribers who've made this episode possible. You've been very generous with your support, going above and beyond and showing you care on too many occasions to count. I look forward to bringing everybody more great content in the future. Okay, that's enough of the business. Let's do this. On the morning of December 24th, 2002, a 27-year-old woman named Lacey Peterson seemingly vanishes from the face of the earth while walking her golden retriever Mackenzie through their Modesto, California neighborhood, which was especially concerning because she was close to 8 months pregnant at the time. Her husband Scott Peterson, who was 30 years old, had apparently just left prior to the incident to go fishing at the Berkeley Marina in Richmond, California, 90 miles away from the couple's home, in a small aluminum boat he'd recently purchased. Lacey doesn't return his calls later that day, and when he gets home from the fishing excursion, he finds the gate to his yard open and the dog running around with a leash still on her neck. But there's no sign of Lacey anywhere. She never comes home. And soon after, a media firestorm will rain down upon her husband Scott, who denies involvement, claiming ignorance about her fate. Until April 13th, 2003, when a human torso washes up on shore in the area where Scott claimed to be fishing on the day of Lacey's disappearance. A male baby had also come ashore nearby, though separated from his mother. DNA testing soon confirms the body belongs to Lacey Peterson, and the deceased infant is none other than Scott and Lacey's unborn son, Connor. Shortly after, Scott is arrested near the Mexican border, and ultimately goes from being the ideal husband to becoming a death row inmate in the California prison system, locked away in San Quentin forever. To this day, he maintains innocence. But what really happened on that fateful Christmas Eve in 2002? Who killed Lacey? Was it her husband, Scott Peterson? Or did the jury get it wrong? Is it possible an innocent man sits on death row, awaiting his fate? Let's take a look at the facts. And of course, we'll delve deep into the psychology of this crime to unearth the emotional connections that created the fireworks leading to the murders. For all intents and purposes, Scott Peterson is a sociopath, whether guilty or not. So that mental illness is the foundation upon which Scott's logic will be built in defending himself against any type of perceived threat. Basically, he's going to lie. Again and again and again, without any regard for its transparency. Welcome to the world of the sociopath, a non-stop comedy routine, but one based in tragedy that's all too real. But here's the point of what I'm saying. The comedy routine begins after the sociopath has been unmasked as being such. Until then, he lives a life where his charms and other resources of manipulation get him what he wants within a framework of concealing the illness to outsiders. Only those closest to the sociopath tend to have knowledge of this monster. But for those who love these people, or follow them, one thing will always be true. He chose them because they would be complicit in hiding the truth. The secret. The way Adnan chose Jay. How Damien chose Jason. And then those two chose Jesse. Adapter to port. We look for those who compliment us. Another way to say, I want to be with somebody like me, is to say, I want somebody who will agree with my lifestyle. And yet another way is just to say, I want someone to agree. So in that regard, if you're a manipulative person, you seek a partner whose personality is conducive to agreeing with your lifestyle, despite its inherent flaws, flaws which totally disregard fairness, equality, and more importantly, empathy. These aren't things you can ask for in a relationship. Imagine yourself sitting down with your partner to explicitly suggest you wanted to degrade, manipulate, and psychologically damage that person in order to live a lie that benefits only you. It's completely outrageous, right? You can't do something like that. The way you introduce those things into a relationship is through action. For instance, if we're in a committed relationship and I cheat on you under circumstances where you should clearly know I'm up to no good, but you feign ignorance for the sake of retaining the perception of what we've built together, it's an unspoken contract. I know I can continue to behave that way based upon your response. But this process takes place in the subtext of our words and actions. Because of this, the sociopath is able to contain his true identity to outsiders. He only enters into sociopathic situations in the comfort of implicit secrecy and privacy, whether it's when he cheats on his wife or strangles somebody to death and buries the body. Accordingly, what we're going to see in this case is that Scott tells his mistress endless lies about his wonderful life, all of which she believes, until he gets exposed as a sociopath. Once he does, everything he says to her, the content of which is no different than it was before the revelation, is a hilarious joke. And suddenly, a woman who clearly got duped makes a total fool of Scott Peterson once he's been exposed, picking apart his lies. The same thing goes with the cops when asking Scott questions. It's hilarious and sad. But above all else, it's tragic for both parties. Ted Bundy had a long-term relationship with a young mother who claimed she had no idea what he was doing. But he was driving a car with no passenger seat, one that routinely contained items intended for use in assaulting, raping, and killing women. Yet she was ignorant. It's not a coincidence why Ted chose her to fill the role of offering him a facade. Very simply, she needed one too. She was a single mom in a time when it wasn't nearly as socially acceptable as it is today, and Ted was able to offer that facade of having a relationship with a handsome older man working toward a law degree. Of course, it was all bullshit, but it succeeded due to both parties being psychologically complicit in a conspiracy to suppress the truth in favor of desire. And the way we go about this is establishing dominance. The dominant party, who, in this case, is the sociopath, will tell the lies, and the submissive party will then suffer them in exchange for being allowed the continuation of the facade. In the case of a normal, healthy relationship, there's a certain constant tension between the two partners that asserts their equality through action. When the sociopath enters a long-term relationship, such as marriage, it's with the implicit agreement among he and his partner that there will be an imbalance in terms of equality, but both parties will still get what they want. For instance, Scott cheated on Lacey repeatedly, yet not only did she seem to be unaware of this reality, but she also reportedly never said a bad word about the guy at all. Yet, as we'll get into with a little more detail later, he was clearly lying to her on a regular basis, and she was a bright young woman. She made that sacrifice for perception. Lacey was supposedly dedicated to creating the perception of the perfect young couple through Scott. He was tall, good-looking, and charming, apparently loved by all, the type of guy a lot of women would be interested in dating. Of course, Lacey was very attractive and intelligent, but so are many other ladies as well. The point is that Scott didn't have to pick her, but he did, and never put up a fight. So how did he go from jumping right on board with a long-term commitment to Lacey to finding himself on death row for her murder to end the relationship? The answer is simple. The sociopath exists within the framework of manipulation, specifically manipulation related to resources. And his wife Lacey was in the late stages of pregnancy. But guess what? You can't manipulate a baby. And they don't have any resources. They can only consume yours continuously as they remain impervious to your charm, good looks, and statuesque height. Babies take and take and take. It never stops. They're wired to behave that way. Unfortunately, so is the sociopath. The sociopath, just like the infant, seeks to have everything handed to him. When it happens, he's able to identify potential partners by their degree of willingness. Accordingly, how does Scott get Lacey's phone number? Somebody hands it to him. At work. And when he throws it out, thinking it's a joke, she comes back to hand it to him personally at the Pacific Cafe. She very bluntly tells him she's interested. And they never look back at this point. It's apparent they're going to get married. So just like every other categorization of humanity, sociopathic tendencies lend themselves very well to one simple rule of movement in our universe. Conservatism. For those who have listened to my show many times, this is me beating a dead horse, but for everybody else, human behavior suggests that we don't exert more energy than necessary when accomplishing a task. So if one person walks into a store to return an item with a calm demeanor, and then another does the same while throwing punches at the cashier, one thing is true regardless. They both firmly believed any action they took was necessary. Anything less wouldn't have gotten the job done. At least, in terms of perception. So in that regard, what makes a person an alpha is the ability to acquire and maintain vast resources without doing very much of one thing. Moving. Male lions don't do shit. I mean nothing. They lie around all day long. A grizzly bear sleeps for months and is then able to feed upon the prey of other predators caught just by approaching them with a slow lumbering walk and scaring them off. This is the most prized evolutionary gift any creature can receive, right up to humanity. If you work in a corporate office, undoubtedly you know leaders are encouraged to move more slowly and speak less often than those working for them. They have a deliberate manner. The inference is that they don't have to move fast, which is a universal symbol of power, aka control of resources. People are coming to them. Here's a great example of a different kind of boss exemplifying this rule. In the legendary Martin Scorsese mafia film Goodfellas, the boss is played by Paul Sorvino, who just so happens to be called Paulie in the film. The director brilliantly plays up this attribute in two separate scenes. One is in the backyard behind Paulie's house, where they're having a family outing. Paulie sits there in silence as he's brought food by other people, and refuses to speak directly to other people, instead whispering short messages into the ear of a runner who passed the messages along. He does the same thing with phone calls, and one scene actually shows a person holding an umbrella for another who's running to a phone in the rain to make a call for Paulie. In another scene at the taxi stand Paulie owns, some of his guys get a little rowdy out front, to which he responds by doing nothing more than stepping outside to show himself. Everybody disperses and gets quiet. And the classic line that's delivered when they show his face at that moment goes like this. Paulie might have moved slow, but that's because Paulie didn't have to move for anybody. That's our world. The soldier on the battlefield, no matter how many weapons she possesses or how much bravery he shows in facing down the enemy, will never possess the enormous capacity to kill that our leaders enjoy. Conversely to Paulie, the subject of the film is Henry Hill, a low-level mob associate who would never even be able to become a true member of the group, and therefore would never be a leader in that regard. And how does he behave? Constant movement, running back and forth between people, hustling, smuggling drugs, telling lies, trying to outrun a helicopter tailing him. The whole movie consists of him trying to shed something, from poverty to identity, in order to place himself in a situation where he can stop running. But he fails badly. By the end of the film, when he's lost everything, guess who becomes the only person who can afford him any resources whatsoever? Paulie. By testifying against him. And why? The cops don't want him. He's a rat, in more than one sense of the word. He's a scavenger, a hustler, a runner. That's why in the film, he starts as an errand boy hustling around selling cigarettes and lighting cars on fire. Who do the cops want? They want the guy who moves slowly, who controls all the resources. Evolution's desire is to redirect those resources appropriately and to do so in the most conservative manner possible. Therefore, it attacks the alpha. So, the idea of being an alpha predator in this world is one based in this truth. Your ability to acquire and utilize resources determines your societal standing. And within that notion, we realize what's most important is the ratio of energy you expend in comparison to the energy you attract. The alpha, like Pauly, falls at the extreme top of the scale, being rewarded greatly for doing very little, while the omega, like Henry Hill, falls at the bottom end of the scale, meaning he's constantly hustling and running around for a fraction of his boss's resources. That's nature, but what the whole movie is about is the one thing that separates human society from its counterparts in nature, and it's the definition of evolution. Change. If you were born a small bear, too bad. The others will be kicking your ass the rest of your life. Deal with it. That's the animal world. Humanity is different. We can identify imbalances and adjust our plight accordingly to succeed. For instance, if you're convinced at age 6 that you want to be a professional basketball player, and find out by age 14 that you're not even 5 feet tall, there's still a lot to live for. You can change course. You can build something and succeed. I think what most people fail to understand about evolution, in terms of the coming switch to artificial intelligence, is that a level playing field, physically and emotionally, or whatever the equivalent is within the framework of AI, actually creates a situation far more conducive to evolving, because currently our resources are hoarded by a precious few who disseminate them to the common people by way of occasionally opening the release valve on stifling oppression. With the playing field becoming level in AI, in terms of intellect and physical stature, our new existence will be forced to discover ways to evolve to the point of physical and intellectual imbalances once again. That's what pushes the ball forward. So basically, what artificial intelligence is going to do is cause the alphas to get off their asses and move in order to give evolution a huge thrust forward. And that's where we get to how this relates to Scott Peterson and his sociopathy. The reason nature, or evolution, wants alphas to start moving is because we're moving. Earth is the only location for resources related to humanity. Artificial intelligence opens the door wide to the universe and beyond. We have no use in breeding creatures who wait for things to come to them based upon perceived value. Evolution has no use for giving handouts beyond the realm of planet Earth. So it's eliminating alpha creatures from their environments that seemingly have no value in that new artificial existence, and doing so by way of the aggression of the omega creatures. Throughout the world, sharks, whales, elephants, and many other species that dominate specific wildlife environments have been relentlessly under attack by humanity, specifically the poorest of people in the poorest of places. Of course, many times they're employed by the wealthy, but they're the ones actually engaging in this action to acquire the resources by way of killing. The message nature is sending is that we're going to have a future related to power expressed by way of movement rather than power expressed by lack of movement. Speed is the element that has changed our existence. Specifically, speed that's led to technological advances, or resulted because of the advances. A cursory examination of any species being slaughtered by humanity will render the following reality, regardless of any other. These creatures weren't fast enough to get away. Speed kills. It's the fucking truth. So what's happening is we're trading in obsolete technology, in the form of ruthlessly slaughtering animals that aren't going to evolve past life on Earth. It's horrible, but one thing that should be pointed out is that it's even more common today than it was when the world was less civilized. With greater speed by way of technology, poachers can eliminate animals in numbers once never thought possible. Notice that with even more money and better technology, law enforcement is unable to put an end to this type of behavior. It only gets worse. And the reason is movement. So many people are doing it so fast and so often with so much disregard for the animals or getting caught that it never stops. There's an endgame at play. It's sad, but it says one thing. The alpha is winning. Humanity, with movement, specifically speed. The message being sent by evolution is this. The alpha of the future will need to move, and do so very quickly. Stagnancy and lack of adaptation, or death in a new world outside the boundaries of the Earth. These signs are everywhere, and always have been. If you're a Star Wars fan, you know the climax of the plot of the original film portrays the Death Star being destroyed. Now, it basically looks like an artificial Earth with its spheric shape. But why does it get blown away? Just like the planet Tatooine turned to dust? Speed. Both things, one a real planet and one artificial, are stagnant. They don't move. But speed not only destroys the Death Star, it allows the rebels to escape, specifically by traveling at light speed to an escape and attack. In the end, they win, by way of movement and speed. But it's only temporary, because we get to see the result of evolution's desires in the next movie, The Empire Strikes Back. Luke almost freezes to death at the start of the movie. The conditions stifle his movement to the point he has to stop. The dark side arrests several of the rebels, stifling their movement. To take it a step further, they then actually carbon freeze Han Solo to render him unable to move at all for the indefinite future. Darth Vader ultimately cuts off Luke's hand, stifling his movement and ending the fight. That's going to be the response from evolution as well. Stifling movement. And we already see it here on Earth. Countries are attacking each other for information related to movement and attempting to stifle economic movement. The notion of a physical war to end all wars is becoming ridiculous. It's much nicer to drink coffee and freeze people's bank accounts. It costs a lot less money, and the superpowers in this world understand the Earth couldn't sustain the hit. And the reason is speed. Technology is light years ahead of what it was in the 1940s when we last had that type of war. That's the reason why some of our nuclear silos haven't been updated since the 1960s. They're falling apart, and the secret has long since been out that they're not going to be fixed. The reason is that we've evolved past something that's still a physical possibility, so we have to retain the perception of nuclear threats. Physical war is now being utilized at the smaller, regional level as a way for military contractors and others who profit off such things to stay in business, including all of the branches of the military themselves as they make substantial technological progress in their equipment by testing in real-world applications. As they remain necessary, they retain funding. And so the story goes until it doesn't. So what that tells us is that the speed with which humans can move on the battlefield to acquire or defend resources is inadequate in the grand scheme of what's going to happen in the future. Everybody will need to move quickly with the information. The alphas will be those parties who precipitate that information being dispersed. So control of information is control of perception. Speed is key. But that level playing field is coming. As technology stands right now, the internet, specifically search engines like Google, have dramatically increased the speed at which we operate. We possess artificial cognitive function, right in our hands. We're geniuses, by the standards of yesterday. Soon the technology will be in our bodies. We'll look however we want, and feel that way too. We won't be envious. The alpha that we currently know will be eliminated. The DNA lottery will be over. Because the inherent flaw in these creatures is this. They don't want to move. And now we're going to watch evolution go to war with Scott Peterson over that same principle. In the end, Lacey and the couple's unborn son Connor will be dead. So in line with what I've said before on the show, the purpose of diseased brains and similar ailments is to offer insight as to how we can construct better AI. This case is a great example of what I mean by that. We'll take a look at the inherent flaws of a reproductive world and how replication will negate these concerns. Is this crazy enough yet? It is? Okay. Let's proceed in dissecting Scott's mind. So, we'll first elaborate upon their initial meeting. As stated, Lacey sends Scott a clear message in handing over her phone number once, but then does it again when she doesn't get a response. What's important to note about this is tradition generally dictates a man approaches a woman asking for a date or her number, but in more recent decades, it's become fairly common for women to assume the role of the person who breaks the ice in that way. In light of that, there's a debate about which method is correct, with some on either side of the fence, and others straddling it. Now, I have no interest in proving anything right or wrong here. What's interesting for me is the specific dynamic of the people in this instance. From the way the situation is described as having transpired, it sounds like Lacey made herself known repeatedly by visiting a friend at Scott's place of work, but Scott never asked her out within a time frame she deemed acceptable, so she approached him to make the first move. So, what really seems to take place is a three-act structure in this event. The first is that Lacey makes herself known, but doesn't draw enough interest to spring Scott into action. The second is that she seeks to meet him halfway by giving the phone number to a liaison in the form of his coworker, but still draws no interest. Finally, she goes right to the source, Scott himself, and literally hands him her phone number. This is when he takes interest. Notice that he turned his attention toward Lacey only when she submitted to using a specific behavioral pattern that required the resources to come right to him. Scott didn't move one inch, not even halfway. Lacey kept moving closer and closer. She passed the test. He knows she's going to engage the same psychology in the relationship, and Scott's going to toy with Lacey every day until it finally kills her. And the reason is this. She gave him everything he wanted. Right up until she brought a baby into the world that was going to redirect those resources away from Scott. As Scott thought Lacey was the root of the problem, she and the baby had to go, which was an even better situation, in his mind, for acquiring more resources by selling their possessions and cashing in on her life insurance policy. So how does a seemingly normal kid like Scott Peterson, who doesn't come from an abusive background and hasn't been in any trouble whatsoever previously, grow to become a cold-hearted, sociopathic murderer who preys on his loved ones? The basis for it is the inability to mature emotionally, specifically to adulthood. Sociopathic tendencies are little more than criminal alternatives to abiding the laws and accompanying niceties of polite society. The criminal activity in question is always related to resources, whether it's burglary, murder, sexual assault, etc. The sociopath takes these actions at the point it's necessary to do so, given his lack of ability to acquire them otherwise. If you're East Area rapist Joe D'Angelo, a cop who actually matches the sketch of said rapist, it's suspicious to enter a hardware store and purchase a can of dog repellent. So what does he do? He steals it. And what happens? He gets caught. And why? Movement, speed, light transfer. He gets caught because he wasn't fast enough. So here we see the beginnings of the relationship between the sociopathic brain and the future of humanity. In this instance, the criminal activity tells us that stealing resources in the absence of adequate speed leads to detection. And what happens? He loses his job, which equates to what? Loss of resources. So, accordingly, he's left with a choice. He can evade detection, or he can go to prison. So, the obvious choice is to move faster. Now, for Scott Peterson, he descends into the first phase of a sociopathic behavioral pattern by cheating on Lacey multiple times and disguising the situation with lies. And he can get away with that, as long as Lacey is still acquiring what she needs from the implicit agreement as well. If we examine what she wants, however, it doesn't amount to much more than perception. Scott never really had to do much beyond being himself, meaning being tall, handsome, and charming. And what we learn about his earlier life is more of the same. Scott is literally referred to as the golden boy by his family, but he sells fertilizer for a living, didn't graduate college until he was about 25 years old, and did a lot of partying and playing golf prior to that. He didn't actually accomplish anything significant of note other than being tall, handsome, and charming. And that's where he learned to have such expectations. In childhood, his family handed him everything. So the story we're offered is that Scott and Lacey meet and are married in 1997, with Lacey getting a job in Prunedale while Scott finishes his last year at college. Every depiction of this tale seems to gloss right over that, and I'm like, Whoa. Hold up. She's graduated college and gotten a job, but Scott still has a year left? What does that say about him when we learn he's 3 years older? It says very clearly that he doesn't work hard, and that Lacey was putting in a lot of effort early on that got her little more than a husband who was already looking elsewhere for romantic involvement and detachment from her, while Lacey remained committed to the perception of the perfect marriage and creating the perfect life with kids. So, it's not difficult to see, even early on, that Scott and Lacey lived different lives. And while the difference might have only been perception, the baby arriving was going to cause their paths to cross this time. Permanently. Scott and Lacey would have to live the same life, meaning Scott would have to concede for the simple fact I already presented, which is that a baby can't be manipulated. It requires endless resources while only offering good looks and charm in return. Just like Scott Peterson. The baby was stealing his thunder. Scott had recently just turned 30 years old at the time of Lacey's disappearance. He was feeling the pressures of adult life, including finding professional success and living up to the golden boy moniker among those closest to him. More and more, he was somebody who was expected to acquire resources through action and for the benefit of somebody other than himself. Once Lacey has the child, her needs and the baby's needs would increase, to no benefit of his own. It would require sacrifice. So, let's go back in the timeline of Scott's adult life, after graduating college. Does he go out and get a job, trying to work his way up from the bottom through hard work and persistence? No. People give him money to open a bar, and it fails. While planning a future in Modesto with Lacey, how does he get a down payment to buy a house? His parents give it to him. I can't confirm this, but supposedly it was offered to Scott. It was handed to him without taking any action. And why? It's believed his parents, especially his mother Jackie, felt Modesto was beneath Scott's status, and she was therefore unwilling to have him living in an apartment there. Of course, why stop there? Scott has a membership at a nearby country club that reportedly costs $25,000 per year in dues, also paid for by his mother. And why? To keep a perception intact that Scott was a golden boy who could do no wrong. Notice that's what Lacey did when they met, and every day afterward. Again, it's reported her friend said she never spoke a bad word about Scott in her life. Men routinely seek the nurturing qualities of their mothers and their mates. So if Scott could do no wrong in his mother's eyes, then he'd need a wife to follow suit. And that's where the problem comes in. Scott brings Lacey into his life because he sees her as a great wife to continue the facade of his perfection into perpetuity. And she's willing. Yet, as opposed to his mother, she's ultimately going to be raising children that are not him. Which means she'll be asking for resources, not offering them. In fact, each instance in Scott's existence where his mother handed him something is going to equate to his wife and son asking for the same. It'll be one sacrifice after another for the greater good of other people. The end. That's being an adult. That's resigning yourself to sacrifice. It costs you resources. So, if you're a sociopath, like Scott Peterson, how do you turn the tables on them? Instead of keeping them at a cost of your resources, you purchase an insurance policy on Lacey's life and kill them to collect the money. Notice it's still a handout. It's given to him. But in that situation, he couldn't profit in the absence of crime. That's how a sociopath's mind works. It's a partially calculated decision. He only asks himself how to go about acquiring the necessary resources. He doesn't concern himself with risk or potential fallout. The logic simply abides the most conservative plan that will allow the person to acquire the resources in question. Evolution has designed the sociopathic brain in this manner because it goes off the rails right at the moment criminal action is taken. He can only operate within the framework of his sociopathy and therefore suffers from a shocking lack of awareness when delivering paper-thin lies that crumple and fall in a wastebasket. Basically, evolution is saying that you can be an alpha by having everybody come to you with vast resources, limiting effort and movement, but you can't steal them. evolution will not honor the false transfer of light. It will come looking for you. Police, security cameras, neighbors looking out windows, phones, tracking devices, cadaver dogs, detectives, public scrutiny, the justice system, prisons, and so on. We spend a ridiculous amount of time and effort catching criminals, and the success of this endeavor is predicated upon a single element: speed. But Scott Peterson isn't interested in moving very fast to avoid detection. As a sociopath, he's confined to the logic that proved successful with his parents, Lacey, and many others who offered handouts just for being him. So, once the theft of resources occurs, in the form of Lacey and her unborn child disappearing, Scott is unable to respond to police questioning in any manner more sophisticated than the bullshit he served up to the aforementioned people. So it becomes a comedy, in a very tragic way. Scott's going to stop at nothing to lie his way to the truth. And the cops see it, plain as day. It's not a hunch. They know he's a sociopath. But without a body, Lacey's just missing. So let's get into the timeline of the crime, now that we have a basis for understanding Scott. Scott claims that the couple woke up on December 24, 2002, and proceeded to watch TV together while using their computers at home. Lacey was on her laptop, and the show they enjoyed was Martha Stewart instructing the world how to make some type of meringue cookies. Scott is very specific about this event, even reciting the time that the particular segment in question was aired. So the police are going to proceed to investigate the contents of these computers and learn that Lacey supposedly conducted a web search for two items on her laptop that morning. One was an umbrella with a sunflower design, and the other was a scarf. Of course, there's a lot of contention as to whether Lacey actually got online and looked for these items, or if Scott did it in her place. Some people believe she was likely already dead at that point. In my mind, they're correct. There's some very fascinating but simple psychology at play in this situation. Scott describes Lacey eating breakfast and conducting other normal morning activities, but the neighbors say the blinds were still shut on the home at 10 a.m., which they claim was highly unusual. It's reported that Lacey routinely opened the blinds every morning when she woke up, so we have a discrepancy between Lacey's normal behaviors and what actually occurs on December 24th. So, the obvious factor to observe here is that Scott appears to indulge in a tactic related to lack of detection. He shelters the inside of the house from view in a situation where he says Lacey was present. We know she'd have done otherwise. Now, let's take a look at the symbolism and metaphorical values present in the online shopping search Lacey supposedly conducted that morning. Afterward, it should be evident who was actually inputting the information in her laptop. One of the two items in question is a sunflower umbrella, meaning an umbrella with a sunflower pattern or design printed on it. And the second is a scarf. Now, it's somewhat of a cold, rainy day in Modesto on Christmas Eve, so at face value, these seem like items that one would be inclined to shop for spontaneously. However, there's no way they'll be arriving the same day as her purchase, or the next day, or even the day after that. In California, it's likely to be sunny again by that time, and warmer, so there seems to be some immediacy tied to the day in question. If Lacey were to have these items on that day, however, let's take a look at the psychology of how they'd be utilized in comparison to how she ends up dead. So, if there was some rain on the morning of December 24, 2002 in Modesto, then Lacey could have used the umbrella to shield herself from the drops pouring down. That's the most obvious and practical way to view the situation. Now let's put it in the context of her death. The umbrella has a sunflower design, and Lacey loves everything sunflowers, so the sunflower on the umbrella represents her. Now, if she's standing in the rain, Connor in her womb, holding the symbolic umbrella, look at what's going on around her. She's on solid ground, and there's water in every direction, to her left and right, and every other angle as well, including, and especially, above, where the rain reaches all the way up to the clouds. Basically, she's surrounded by water, but shielded from it by something that covers her. That's exactly the way Scott would have to dispose of Lacey in the ocean, wrapped in something protective and surrounded by water that extends way up above the place where she rests on solid ground at the ocean floor. Otherwise, transporting her exposed body in the truck and boat would have left ample DNA evidence, of which none was ever found. The psychology says that Scott wanted to keep the sunflower surrounded by water. And when we hold umbrellas, what do we know happens if we don't grip them tightly? They blow away. Your hand is an anchor. And that hand has five fingers, four of which are similar, but one that is different, the thumb, specifically because it diametrically opposes the location of the others while retaining the same purpose. Accordingly, Scott Peterson constructs five anchors out of concrete, four of which are never seen again, and assumed to have been utilized as anchors to hold down Lacey's body in the water. And what does Scott do with the other one? He keeps it on the boat for use as an anchor. So all five anchors have the same purpose of anchoring an object that's being shielded from the water by something, but diametrically opposed engagement, meaning that the anchors on the ocean floor are intended to keep an object from rising, while the anchor on the boat is intended to prevent lateral movement of the vessel that changes its location. If you examine that same scenario holding an umbrella, utilizing the notion of wind rather than ocean current, you'll notice that the four fingers on your hand that grip the umbrella prevent it from lifting upward in the wind, in the same way the anchors on the ocean floor prevent the current from pulling the body upward. Conversely, the placement of the thumb on an umbrella prevents lateral movements of wind from breaking the object free from your grip, in the same way the anchor in the boat is used to keep lateral ocean currents from breaking the boat free of its current position. In both cases, the boat and the umbrella blow around in the wind and current, but never detach from the object to which they're anchored. And that's getting deep inside Scott Peterson's head. Notice that Lacey's body lifts upward from the ocean floor, like the umbrella would lift up out of your hand, when it becomes detached from the grip of the four anchors, just like the umbrella would when becoming separated from your four similar fingers. And when does this event take place? After a very big storm. And what two elements do storms combine? Rain and wind. So if you're wondering why Scott Peterson was spotted at the marina on numerous days after Lacey's disappearance, just staring out over the water, it's because his intuition, despite his inferior intellect, was telling him the truth. That body, as predetermined by the psychological manifestation of an umbrella in Scott's mind, was going to rise when the rain and wind finally came. It happened. Is that crazy enough for you? You won't find that shit on the Wikipedia page. Anyhow, the internet search on Lacey's laptop from the morning of her disappearance, the one Scott claims she genuinely performed, as mentioned previously, includes results for a potential scarf purchase. Now, we've already examined the practical application for utilizing an umbrella on a rainy day, as opposed to the psychology it represents in the context of Lacey's murder. So let's render the same type of profile for the reasons behind choosing to find a scarf. So again, the cool weather dictates that wearing a scarf might be beneficial for obvious reasons, just like holding an umbrella. But why is it important on this particular day? Again, let's cast aside the practical application, just like we did with the umbrella, and view the inherent psychology. What it shows us is that a scarf is not only wrapped around a person's neck, but also conceals the neck. Furthermore, notice that when applying a scarf to your body, the first step would be wrapping it around your neck, and at the end of the process, only then would the neck be fully concealed from sight. And here's where I go way off the rails. One of the greatest mysteries in this case is how Lacey was killed. And where? There's no physical evidence to suggest the truth regarding either consideration. So we're going off the fucking deep end, all the way back to Scott's infancy. Now, before heading there, let's examine why we need to take the journey. Scott, according to his later guilty conviction, committed a murder, or a double murder, technically, in the absence of signs of a struggle. He didn't sustain any defensive wounds, nor did any particular area in the house become suspicious as being the spot of any type of bloodbath. We're going to learn that Scott does act strangely, in terms of compulsively showing attention to certain areas, like his kitchen floor and in front of the clothes dryer, but again, this doesn't indicate blunt trauma as the cause. All signs point to a quiet death that negated detection by outsiders. Nobody heard screaming, loud music, or even the TV getting turned up. It was quiet, cold, calculated, sudden. Not the product of an explosive argument. All signs point to Lacey being surprised by Scott, and subsequently being unable to defend herself, to an extent she left not so much as a scratch on his body. So the options for bringing about such a death by traditional means are somewhat limited, and it goes without saying that strangulation and or smothering are at the top of the list. Beyond that, poisoning is a possibility, but not nearly as practical because it requires use of a foreign substance that originates by way of purchases that can be traced, and also has the potential to leave a physical mess. Needless to say, it isn't much of a surprise that Lacey's autopsy revealed the notion that some of her ribs had been broken prior to being dumped in the ocean. If you consider how and when that might have happened, it's pretty clear that once she was dead, there wouldn't be a reason to get rough with her while moving the body. Despite the fact that it's heavy, it will also make loud noises, draw attention, and leave physical evidence if not transported with the greatest care. So, the totality of no defensive wounds, no eyewitness testimony of an argument, or any evidence in the house to suggest anything malicious happened, aside from Lacey's disappearance, it seems to me the most likely cause of death was strangulation, smothering, or a combination of both. It would have been in a situation where Lacey was most vulnerable and least able to fight back to the extent she could scratch or hit Scott in a way that would leave evidence of a struggle. With that said, we also know Lacey was found with part of her tan pants she wore December 23rd still on her body, and there was no evidence of sexual assault. What that tells me is that she was still asleep in bed on the morning of December 24th prior to 8 a.m., the time when Scott says they were in the living room. Lacey was lying on her side in bed, under the covers on a chilly December morning. Scott did nothing more than wake up, straddle her on top of the blankets to prevent her from moving her arms or scratching him with her fingers, and allow his weight to sink and crush her ribcage, thereby suffocating her and simultaneously breaking three upper ribs. Meanwhile, he's either holding a pillow flat against the side of her face as she lies on her side, or he's put something over her head, such as a plastic bag, to restrict her breathing. Either way, the method employs a strategy that yields suffocation, death, and lack of detection regarding the identity of the perpetrator. It doesn't matter that Scott is going to kill Lacey and she won't even be able to identify him. His specific brand of sociopathic tendencies suggest that, as the golden child who can do no wrong, his intention is to retain that perception. So I believe this incident occurred early in the morning, prior to Lacey's supposed internet search and TV session watching Martha Stewart. And it was a surprise. Lacey never saw Scott coming. But worse, he was intent upon suffocating not only the mother, but the child as well. Notice that the most explosive, violent, unsympathetic event of Scott Peterson's life involves making sure a woman he supposedly loves suffocates until she dies, and asphyxiates the child he's supposed to love and find empathy for, above all else. But he can't find empathy. Ever. He can only find indifference. Why is that? Why does he just go on pretending everything is fine afterward, by lying continuously, when it's obvious most of these falsehoods are transparent? Why have all of his romantic relationships with women been disloyal to a great extent, right up to and including marriage? Why has he been unable to form bonds with them? Why do women describe Scott as cold, robotic, and stoic? As I mentioned earlier, why couldn't he just leave Lacey and look like a bad guy, instead of killing her and ruining everybody's life? And the answer is that he had to maintain the appearance that nothing was wrong. And that he did nothing wrong. Ever. Scott Peterson became a murderous sociopath because he'd always been taught to repress his emotions. From childhood right into adulthood, it was expected. So it isn't very difficult to learn where these expectations originated. Just follow the resources, and follow the symbolism. Scott's parents had the resources. The symbolism is the cause of death, the inability to breathe, which again is either strangulation, suffocation, or both. So the elements we have here are emotional repression, maintaining appearances, mother and child struggling to breathe by way of something they can't control, mom by way of her face, and the baby from within an isolated enclosure in the form of his mother's womb. That's the cocktail. Scott Peterson explodes with venomous rage in this single moment of his life. never before, never after. Let's look at how that came to be. At an early age, Scott's mother Jackie is living in an orphanage that's notorious for rendering horror stories of abuse of all kinds. Physical, emotional, and more importantly, sexual. It's believed that Jackie undoubtedly suffered many of these injustices in her time living there, but she claims it was a wonderful experience with no abuse present. Of course, many people dispute that notion as blatantly false, asserting that she would have certainly been subjected to such behavior in her time at the orphanage. Needless to say, she pretends that everything was perfect, in the same way that she claimed Scott was perfect, despite his obvious sociopathic tendencies. In addition to that, Jackie has suffered from an asthmatic condition from an early age that causes her to have serious breathing issues. To this day, she wears an apparatus on her face that allows her to receive oxygen by way of tubes. So Scott's mother couldn't breathe properly. And then, what happens to him? As a baby, Scott contracts pneumonia, suffers severe breathing issues, and has to be isolated from contact with others, especially his mother, which is devastating to him because it's at an age where mother and child form their earliest bonds. He's placed in an oxygen tent, alone, crying, wanting, needing his mother. But there's no empathy. She doesn't come. He lies there, helpless, suffocating. Scott employs a strategy of suffocation or strangulation in the murder of his wife and unborn son because the situation epitomizes the root of his lack of empathy. He didn't get to bond with his mother at a time he absolutely needed to. And so, when it comes time to display any sort of empathy toward his victims, he can't. In actuality, it seems that Scott Peterson never actually engaged in any type of empathetic romantic relationship with a woman. It was always about his needs. And this is where we understand why. As many of you know, I've spoken about crime, especially murder, mirroring the emotional pain of the perpetrator. So if you recall, earlier in the show I said Scott Peterson's breaking point for resorting to murder and preventing Lacey from giving birth is this: you can't manipulate a baby. And that's what's so painful for Scott. He knows this is an irrefutable truth, because he experienced it as an infant. Like I said earlier, infants cry, wave their arms, and shit their pants to get what they want. You can't talk them out of it. So here's baby Scott Peterson, gravely ill and desperate for his mother as an infant, but she's not there. And she doesn't come when he whines, or cries, or screams. He suffers every moment of it, because you can't manipulate a baby. The bottom line, from a symbolic standpoint, is that his mother didn't care when he couldn't breathe. She didn't help him. That's what he internalized as an infant, rational or not. So what does he grow up to do? He makes women come to him. In fact, he makes everybody come to him. Like we said, everything is handed to Scott. Even Lacey's phone number. He demands nothing less in exchange for being the golden boy and pretending everything is fine. That's what his mother wanted. It's what Lacey wanted, too. Appearances. Tragically, that's what they got. The perfect son was a lie. The perfect husband proved a facade. It was all deception. Scott Peterson is, was, and always has been a sociopath. It's learned behavior. The first thing he does after getting married is find a girlfriend. He starts talking to her about opening a business together. But what he won't do is say he's married. He buys her 6 dozen roses on their first date. But when she catches him in bed with Lacey, he doesn't even bother to say it's his wife. Somebody else tells her. And Scott doesn't have to repair his relationship with Lacey after this. she turns her head, and he starts another relationship with a different woman shortly after. So it comes as no surprise, then, that coming down the home stretch toward the day of Lacey's disappearance, when she's especially housebound by her condition, Scott decides he needs to find a girlfriend. In November of 2002, he meets a young single mother named Amber Fry, who's really overwhelmed by his charm. Of course, Scott lies and tells her he's not married and never has been. The two begin dating, and the manipulation gets underway almost instantly afterward. And there is no level to which Scott Peterson won't stoop. Now, Amber and Scott reportedly begin talking on November 2nd and have their first date on the 20th of that month. Of course, if you consider that Scott's married and seeing Amber on the side for a period of no more than 35 days before Lacey disappears, it becomes odd that Amber routinely refers to them being in a relationship. Throughout multiple interviews with her, you'll notice the word relationship being thrown around. But how many times do you think Scott actually saw her in that single month? What I'm getting at is that Scott was engaging in the same thing he did with women in the past while married, attempting to have a serious relationship predicated upon a potential future together. Just as he told a previous, quote, girlfriend he wanted to start a business with her, Scott's doing the same to Amber by making long-term suggestions about how things are going to be. Not only that, but he employs a very specific tactic in these affairs outside of his marriage, which is a technique that's become very popular in the dating world among guys like him. Love bombing. Love bombing is overwhelming somebody you just met with sweetness and promises in order to lure them into your web, at which point you become controlling, demanding, or otherwise, in a way that causes the victim to become desperate to retain your love. Basically, you make them come to you. You make them hand things to you. First it's their phone number, then it's their hearts, and finally their dignity. There's no legitimate bond between them. No real empathy. Just the appearance of such. Like the relationship between Scott and his mom. Scott makes women come to him under the guise of love, in order to hurt them because his mother didn't come to him to offer love when he was isolated in an oxygen tent as an infant. And he was expected to pretend everything was okay. As a child, an adolescent, a college student, a married man, always pretending, just like his mother. She endured abuse that prompted her to repress emotions and pretend everything was okay. In turn, she did the same thing with her son, Scott. He was always a sociopath, a liar, a cold-hearted, evil person. But it was a secret, because he was enabled by everybody in his life. Check this out. Scott tells the police that Lacey knew about his relationship with Amber, and they, as well as the public, in addition to Lacey's friends and family, balk at the very notion of such. But with all due respect, they're 100% wrong. Lacey absolutely knew about the affair. There's no chance that Scott told her explicitly, face to face, and in those words, but this was a pattern throughout their marriage. Scott was cheating on a regular basis with women he was attempting to charm beyond sexual considerations, often suggesting long-term relationships were going to transpire in the process. On no fewer than two occasions, Lacey was in the presence of one of Scott's girlfriends when they finally confronted him about his lies. We're talking about a couple that was married for only 5 years. Scott had multiple girlfriends during that time. Not one-night stands, not flings. Relationships involving empty promises. He could have cheated and easily had sex with a number of women without so much as telling one lie. There are all sorts of people in the world. Some won't sleep with you if you're married. Some will. Notice, though, that Scott has to hurt all of them. That's the way it has to go. Infidelity for the purpose of sexual satisfaction means nothing to him. That's the plight of most men who cheat. Something has prompted them to look for sex outside of the home, right or wrong. Sometimes relationships develop from that. even marriages. But the inciting incident is almost always related to sexual desire. Scott's manipulation and lies aren't getting him laid, though. He's using them to love-bomb these women and construct false relationships that he can bring down like a house of cards later to hurt them. And guess what? His wife is no different. We seem to think of the mistresses as extraneous to Scott's marriage, but all of these relationships are the same thing. He did to Lacey what he did to the others, but she had to die because he allowed her to take the fantasy too close to reality. The baby was real. The mortgage was, too. Same goes for making a living selling fertilizer. He wasn't the perfect golden boy. He wasn't a professional golfer. He was a husband, a mediocre salesman, and a father-to-be. But worst of all, he was increasingly expected to be a provider. They were taking his resources. He couldn't manipulate the baby. By extension, he couldn't manipulate Lacey regarding the baby either. So yes, Scott can pretend he isn't in a relationship with Amber Fry by telling his pregnant wife his boss is making him go out of town suddenly on business, but he can't escape the responsibility of providing resources. That was the implicit deal she made, turning her head for resources. So Scott had to end a relationship, just like he did with the girlfriends before the time came that he actually had to deliver on his promises. But the problem becomes that marriage and a child means you can't escape responsibility to one thing, providing resources to those parties affected by the sudden separation. Alimony, child support. Scott would be mired in these things for almost 20 years. Guess what that means? They wouldn't be handing him anything. It would all be going the other way. And Scott Peterson has had everything handed to him in his entire life. So what does he do? Easy. He creates a situation where the relationship definitively ends and the resources are then set to flow back the other way, specifically by taking out the aforementioned life insurance policy on Lacey, killing her, and collecting the funds. Beyond that, she also has about $100,000 worth of jewelry she inherited from her family. This isn't just speculation. Scott gets rid of her vehicle right after she goes missing, trading it in for something he prefers for himself. Now, getting back to the point about Lacey's awareness of the relationship with Amber Fry, her friends and family will say she had no clue it was taking place. In fact, you can just do an online search for info about this case, and you'll come across several sources, including video, where we have what I call the circle of friends who think they know everything, but really don't know shit because the person in question cares greatly about appearances. It equates to the she would have told us syndrome of denial and ignorance that's on display to the point of hilarity. The reality is that Lacey absolutely would not have told her sister or friends about any knowledge of Amber Fry because it would have shattered the perfect perception she so carefully crafted about her husband and life at a time when she's pregnant. These same people, in the same interview, say that Lacey would have told them about Scott's extramarital affair, but also say that she never said a bad word about Scott. So, if Scott had multiple girlfriends of which Lacey was explicitly aware, while married, and she said nothing bad about him to friends or family, why would she start with Amber? And why would friends be convinced the rules changed? The answer is that they're suffering from the sickness she indulged. Perception. These people are in Lacey's life for the same reason Lacey was in Scott's life. They catered to this nonsense, and it's total bullshit. But we all do it. For ourselves. For each other. For our sanity. Despite that, it always ends in tragedy. We always get exposed as being nothing less than a total fraud who specifically has to seek the affection of others who are somehow willing to put up with our shit. That's who you are. That's who I am. And it was every day of Scott and Lacey. Our existence is nothing more than lies, conspiracy, and repetitive deception. And in a world full of dishonesty, people are desperate to sell you their truth. With that, please notice the truth being peddled here is from a fertilizer salesman. That's Scott Peterson, a bullshit con artist. But we're intrigued. because that's us too. Anyhow, let's get back to the timeline on the day of Lacey's disappearance. So we assume that Scott has already killed Lacey before Martha Stewart comes on TV and the internet search takes place on her laptop. That show ends around 9 a.m., and Scott reportedly leaves in his truck to go fishing an hour later at 10. Now, this is where things get a bit sketchy. We can confirm that Scott did in fact leave his home around this time, and did so in his truck. But again, the neighbors say the blinds are closed in the house up until this time, when Lacey always opened them. So right here we have our first instance of turning light to darkness, which indicates an attempt at lack of detection. Now that's a fairly obvious observation, but the reason it's important is that it suggests a wrongdoing occurred prior to it. Moving ahead, 10 a.m. rolls around, and Scott drives out to a warehouse where he's keeping the boat he's going to use for fishing. Of course, Scott hasn't told anybody about this purchase. Lacey didn't know, nor did his parents, or even her parents. So when Lacey's mom learns about this after her disappearance, she confronts Scott for an explanation regarding this mysterious boat. And what she receives in return is a quintessential sociopathic response, one highlighted by a very specific motivation. False transfer of light in relation to resources. The sociopath lives there. Listen to it unfold. Scott tells Lacey's mom that he purchased the boat for her husband as a surprise gift. He literally just dumped her daughter's dead body with this boat and hid its existence prior to that, but he tries to make the item a gift. It's outrageous, unreasonable, and totally fucking crazy. But guess why it happens? Scott has nothing to offer people who come to him asking for things. So he has to fabricate them. That's why it's so easy for him to make promises to all of these women and move on. He really doesn't have anything to offer. It's all false transfer of light related to resources. He promises things like love, opening a business together, having children, and the list goes on. But he delivers on nothing. He never shows up in the end. He abandons women, leaves them heartbroken, like he was in the oxygen tent. Alone, crying. And when that finally failed, silenced. In the end, mother was permanently separated from child. Scott from his mom, as he rots in prison for the rest of time, and Connor from Lacey, as they rest in peace. And what was the common thread between the two incidents? Suffocation. The inability to breathe in this world. Literally, metaphorically, symbolically. So, how do all of us leave this earth? What is the last thing we ever experience? We stop breathing. Anyhow, once Scott leaves for the alleged fishing trip on the morning of December 24th, claiming that Lacey is still alive at the time, it seems there might be reason to believe him. Or is there? You see, neighbors later report seeing a young pregnant woman matching Lacey's description, walking a dog through a local park after Scott leaves to go fishing. In actuality, it amounts to more than 10 people, so it seems there's good reason to look further into this development. Now, around 10:18 a.m., a neighbor notices the gate to the Petersons' backyard is wide open. When Scott returns later that day, he's going to find the same thing, only inside the gate, he crosses paths with their golden retriever, Mackenzie, who's running around back there with a leash attached to her, but nobody around. It seems as though someone had been walking the dog, became separated from her, and never returned. Or is that just what Scott Peterson wants people to think? Because police are ultimately able to locate the woman who is suspected of being Lacey walking the dog in the park, and it wasn't her, despite firm assertions by witnesses that it was. But it's apparent from Lacey's activities in the days preceding her disappearance that she was suffering from a lot of discomfort related to her size in the latter stages of pregnancy. Things like her feet being swollen and hurting. So it's difficult to believe she'd venture out on a cold, damp morning for what would amount to walking a significant distance, when Scott has been awake and able to walk the dog for hours. Can you imagine being a grown man with a pregnant wife who goes fishing all day and leaves her to walk the dog when you had hours to do it in the morning? Every woman I've ever met, in this circumstance, would expect me to get my ass outside and walk the dog first. But Scott can't concede this truth, because there's no other way to put Lacey outside of the house at the time. Again, look where he fails because he's a sociopath. False transfer of light related to resources. He's trying to put her in a certain location at a certain time without that event ever actually taking place. This is why the sociopath relies on people coming to him. By manipulating other people to take action, by way of emotion, you negate the physical necessity for wrongdoing. That's why Scott needs everything handed to him. He can't deceive. He can only manipulate. And so he succeeds with profound success in personal relationships that involve this endeavor of manipulation, but once he's forced to resort to physical means with Lacey and his unborn son, everything starts to crumble. The sociopath is exposed when requirements, specifically resources, are not met through emotional manipulation, and he's forced to engage physicality. Here's a great example I've talked about briefly in a previous show. Early Ted Bundy is a handsome, charming law student who's able to separately lure two beautiful young women away from Lake Sammamish by wearing a fake arm cast and telling lies. He never so much as touches them. They come right to him. They just get right in his car. It's terribly tragic, but watch the tragedy turn the tables and slap Ted in the face. Late Ted Bundy, prior to his final arrest, the Chi Omega murders in Florida that ultimately got him executed, says he's going to head to Florida and remain low-key, planning to kill no one at all. But what happens is an aging, strung-out, fugitive Ted Bundy can't acquire the resources he needs that way. But he's no longer capable of the manipulation he once was because he's been exposed as a sociopath, specifically a rapist and murderer of young women. He's on the run. So Ted goes out to a nightclub hoping to meet some young women, or at least one, believing this is the best course of action because it's worked in the past. But again, he's changed. He has this look in his eyes that says he can't hide the mental illness anymore. By all accounts, the college students who were partying there that night said that he looked like a creep and seemed dangerous. He was. Accordingly, the guy who could once pick up two beautiful women in succession at a park on the same day is no longer so much as able to find somebody drunk and willing at a college bar. And guess what? Ted knows his charm is done. Again, he's been exposed and is no longer enjoying that power of manipulation. So what does he do? He resorts to physicality. Ted Bundy leaves the club and goes directly to a sorority house very close to this location, where he breaks in the back door because the locking mechanism isn't functioning properly. Notice the use of force to get inside. He's not luring anybody anymore. He's hiding, creeping, in the dark. That's what he's become. He then bashes in the heads of five young women sleeping inside, killing two. In the aftermath, he ends up representing himself in court, which has become more classic than some of the comedies produced by Hollywood during that era. And the reason? Once the sociopath has been exposed, he can't falsely transfer light. Complicity is key. When they come to him, he can manipulate. When he goes to them, he has to use force. And that's when he gets in trouble. The end is near. That's Scott Peterson the moment he has to resort to putting his hands on Lacey to get what he wants. His demise is inevitable. It's merely an endgame from there. So let's follow that journey, starting with tying up some loose ends from the day of the murder. Scott's fishing trip launches from a marina 90 miles from his home, which is timed as approximately a 90-minute drive, except that he stops at the warehouse to get the boat. At that point, he goes to the marina, where it's confirmed he arrived at the time he claims. He launches his boat and goes out on the water for 90 minutes, claiming he went fishing. But it's not like he comes back with any fish, or is even equipped to properly handle the task. In fact, he doesn't even possess the knowledge required to fabricate a story about what type of fishing he did when grilled by a detective with knowledge of such things. And why? The conversation resulted from an action that required the sociopath to use force rather than manipulation. When they do that, they get the polar opposite of the result they enjoy with manipulation. People who can't be manipulated are attracted to them, the foremost of such being the police if you've committed a crime. And again, the polar opposite result will occur. Instead of being handed everything, you'll have absolutely nothing to offer when asked to provide. In this instance, what's expected of Scott is answers that are conducive to fact. But he can only offer the same thing he would have offered those he manipulated for so long. Lies. Transparent lies. But because the lies are delivered in the absence of Scott's resources the other party wants and needs, they come out as punchlines. The key is that you can only believe his shit if you want to. Lacey did. His mother did. His father did. So did Amber Fry and countless other women he misled. They all wanted to believe he was the golden boy, even if it was a big fat lie. Because Scott could offer perception. Unfortunately for him, homicide detectives are not in the business of appearances. They're trained to pull back the curtain. So when Scott gets home later that day, supposedly expecting to go to dinner at Lacey's parents' house, he finds the dog in the backyard and Lacey missing. Now, my show isn't the type where we're going to go through all of the nuances of the facts that day, because a lot of it pertains to accuracy rather than psychology, but the gist of what occurs here is that Scott doesn't contact police right away. In fact, he isn't the person who makes the 911 call. He uses the dog as a starting point and begins looking around for Lacey in the neighborhood and at the park nearby. Scott eventually talks to police as they arrive and is introduced to a Detective Brocchini, who is basically going to make him eat his lies one by one until the charade falls apart. Detectives recognize a sociopath when they see one, and a good sign is that, after the initial interview, you don't even ask the detective what he's going to do next. Your wife and unborn son are missing in a situation that seems to involve foul play, but you're not acting with urgency or great concern. That's a dead giveaway. It doesn't make you guilty, it makes you a sociopath. This is a dire situation. It's not a period of grieving in the aftermath of her death. Obviously, Lacey doesn't come home that day, or ever again. So Christmas passes, and the new year is rolling in as Scott starts to garner a lot more suspicion from friends, family, and the public. Police have not named him as a suspect because Lacey's body hasn't been found, but they know this is a chess match. They're waiting it out because they're convinced he dumped that body. And it'll come up. In the meantime, Scott is doing everything he can to not have his picture taken or be filmed, and the crisis center handling the case reports that every time they place a picture of him and Lacey together on the wall, he takes it down. Again and again. He only allows pictures of Lacey by herself. So, there has to be a reason for this, right? Well, police soon learn that his wedding album is in a trash can at the storage facility where he's keeping his boat. His wife is missing, and he throws out their wedding album. But there has to be more than disregard for Lacey at play. Scott would only do that if resources were at stake. Of course, we soon learn why. Amber Fry catches wind of the fact that Scott is the husband of the missing Modesto woman on TV, and immediately reports to police that she's been involved with this man. They ask her to record her cell phone conversations with him, to which she promptly agrees. While they're setting up the phone, Scott calls, and what follows over the coming days is nothing short of hilarious. More on that in a second, but in the meantime, Detective Brocchini wants to get a look at Scott's boat one night, so they meet at the warehouse to indulge the curiosity. Of course, Scott leaves the light off, and what follows is a great example of the dynamics of the power play between light and dark in our world. The detective asks him to turn the lights on, and Scott replies that the power is out due to a problem in the area. Now, the detective knows it's bullshit, but he also knows the best move is to prove it isn't true when Scott isn't around, rather than call him out on it and risk having Scott clam up and refuse to cooperate further. So instead, he asks Scott if he can pull his car up to the open warehouse door and shine the headlights in at the boat. Scott looks wary of this action, but agrees. Of course, the detective isn't going to find any damning evidence while looking around the boat in the dark, but Brocchini is basically telling him that there's nowhere left to hide. He takes a look around, says he's satisfied, and leaves. Once he's out of Scott's presence, he calls the power company and learns what he suspected all along. Scott lied to him. There wasn't any problem with the power in that area. But notice one thing. What is the lie related to specifically? False transfer of light in conjunction with resources. That's the breeding ground of the sociopath. After this, Scott becomes the walking punchline that I mentioned a moment ago. Amber is going to play along with his manipulation to humor the cops' desires on their recorded phone calls, but she's also going to pry the lid back on some of these lies Scott thinks are airtight, but are truly garbage spewing from a metaphorical dumpster. The major lies that Scott tells Amber in their relationship are the falsehood that he isn't and has never been married, and the follow-up to that, in which he insists that Lacey was already missing from his life before he made certain promises to Amber. He tells her Lacey was actually missing beginning December 9th. In response, Amber questions Scott as to how someone can go missing after already being missing. And Scott actually replies, this isn't a joke, that there are different kinds of missing. And he expects her to empathize with that answer. Of course, it escalates from there because Scott doesn't know this is being recorded. He thinks she only knows that his wife is missing. He's going to call her right through the holidays, even going so far as to enlighten her about the finer points of a European vacation he's not actually on. Imagine this. His wife is missing under suspicious circumstances, being searched for desperately, and he's telling a mistress what a wonderful time he's having in France. Beyond that, he offers an anecdote about spraining his ankle while jogging on authentic cobblestone streets, and says he wishes she was there. It's enough to make anyone vomit. The same lies Amber wanted to believe only weeks earlier became vile and disgusting jokes once the sociopath was exposed. Perhaps the pinnacle of this behavior is at a candlelight vigil being held for Lacey when she's missing over the holidays. While her family is on stage recognizing a large crowd that's come out to show its support, Scott Peterson isn't with them. He's off to the side in the crowd, with his head lowered and talking on his phone. He's actually bragging to Amber about being in France for New Year's at the time and being really close to the Eiffel Tower, unable to hear much due to fireworks. This is really the point when everybody realizes the true level of evil at work. This guy isn't a one-trick pony. He's a monster. Once it surfaces, it can't be concealed. They have to get him off the streets. But in the absence of physical evidence, that doesn't happen until April 2003, when the bodies wash ashore right where Scott had been fishing the day of Lacey's disappearance. This guy was officially toast. Scott knows two bodies have washed ashore. It's on the news, and he's the only person who doesn't have to wait for confirmation of who it is before he acts. He already knows. And it's here we get a great glimpse inside the environment that fostered his sociopathic tendencies. His home life with his parents. Scott colors his hair red, or a reddish blonde, and packs his car full of everything from snacks to camping gear, to Viagra, and even tosses $15,000 in cash on top. Needless to say, he's about to run, and his parents live in San Diego, so guess where police learn he is at the time? That's right. So, if you're innocent, why disguise yourself and head toward the border when the bodies are found? If you're innocent, the bodies being found has a significant chance of proving that, upon autopsies of each, you were not guilty. Instead, police follow him in a strange pursuit that sometimes reaches high speeds, but they don't pull him over until he reaches the entrance of Torrey Pines Golf Club. Notice that he has no chance to escape them, and actually doesn't even try, instead opting to make his arrival at the golf club more important than facing the music, or even trying to flee across the border. And why? One of the only two people left in the world who can stomach his lies anymore and still thinks he's the golden boy is his father, Lee. So Lee assures police that Scott had no intention to flee the country, that he had disguised his appearance to avoid overwhelming media attention. He actually tries to convince the cops that Scott was meeting him to play golf and was in possession of his brother's driver's license to use his ID to enter the course in the process. Are you fucking kidding me? Is this the same Scott Peterson who purchased a Mercedes in his mother's name to avoid detection by police, telling salespeople that he was indeed Jacqueline Peterson, but that he goes by the nickname Jackie? These aren't things he did behind their backs. They condoned this behavior. They always had. That was Scott Peterson's whole life. When it came down to it, and his shit stunk with every person alive on the planet, except Mommy and Daddy, he ran to them. The male sociopath is nothing more than a giant baby waving his arms and crying. He's a man who couldn't grow up, who couldn't abide the laws of society and nature. Evolution has a built-in defense system to stop these people in their tracks. The only type of person who's able to make a living off the false transfer of light is a magician. But upon closer inspection, his tricks aren't real. And notice that the tall, good-looking, and charming man who had everything handed to him in life by people coming to him gets his wish in the most tragic way possible. The police come right to him. All of them. Surrounding him. Just like everybody else. But they arrest him. And this time, it's over for Scott. Despite a lengthy trial, he's found guilty and sentenced to death for the crimes. He remains on death row at San Quentin. And there's a lot more to this case, but it doesn't necessarily enhance the narrative of what we're talking about here, so I'll leave it to your curiosity. In closing this out, what I really want to focus on is something that haunts me about this case. Obviously, the circumstances are terrible, with Lacey and Connor being murdered. But I keep looking in the rear view at how it all came to be. So, I think what bothers me the most is the truth about these implicit relationships into which we all enter, which are, at some level, driven by complicity and or compliance with something. It's a power struggle, one that never seems to end. Not even in our dreams, where the conflicts are all entirely foreign, yet so familiar. Resources are constantly shifting in our world, exploding from primal desire into thought, and finally erupting like fireworks in front of our eyes in physical form. And what we learn within that notion is that the magician's tricks are real. They're no more or less tangible than anything else in this world. It all disappears. It dies. The difference between his tricks and ours is one thing. Speed. Evolution. And how does Scott, the big burly alpha of yesteryear, go down in the end? As a result of speed. The cops were faster, with information, equipment, surveillance, and everything else you can possibly imagine. That's the new alpha. Everything is getting faster. We're trying to dominate each other with speed. In the technology sector, in government reconnaissance, on the battlefield, in the air, in space, in journalism, on social media, in our dating apps. It's everywhere. So we're all entering into an increasing number of these implicit relationships, whether it's a simple text message exchange or something more significant. That means that the desperation and lies will follow. The hopelessness. The despair. We take more. From everybody. With that desperate look. A vampire. The dead. We all want the resources. And control. But have to balance fear and action to get them. How much do I take? How much do I give? What do I owe this world? What does it owe me? When should I lie? When are others lying? Why am I so scared? So, I think what we need to realize is that fear causes our thoughts to be on the other side of the fence from our potential actions for a reason. If we didn't have it, civility would be impossible. We'd all try to take everything from each other at every moment of the day, without warning, like savages. That's why the attempt at acquiring great resources comes with a great deal of fear. Evolution only wants you on that side of the fence. Action, when you're creating, it will reward you. But if you hop the fence, ignore the fear, and take everything you want, it will get you. And that's what happened to Scott Peterson. But sadly, as a sociopath, he didn't act in spite of fear. He simply wasn't experiencing any. That's what made him a monster. And so I ask myself, in my own life, am I a monster too? Have I cheated? Lied? Manipulated? Do I even know the truth? What makes me a good person? Or bad? It's all so dizzying, a maddening cacophony of noise in my head that just keeps getting faster and faster. I walk through this world constantly asking and wondering and screaming on the inside. All of these questions with no answers, or wisdom that changes from day to day. And these solutions. This will fix it, but only tomorrow. When I make more promises to myself that are really all lies, so when I ponder reality, there's nowhere to hide from these never-ending problems and all of the hurdles in a temporary life that sours and curdles. Just like spoiled milk, it becomes rotten with age, and all I can think is that's me. I'm trapped in a cage. I've been given advice and feel that it's sage, but to tell you the truth, I'm still feeling the rage. All of this lightning, it's followed by thunder, but after this storm, there's a sky full of wonder where I look to the stars and try to find meaning, yet there's none that I see. That's the way that I'm leaning. Suffice it to say, it's stuck in my head. If I end it all now, I could get out, but instead, I've decided I'll stay and be a rat in this race to give others my love, but only in case I arrive and find out there's no heavenly place at the end of this rainbow, the culmination of life. As your soul leaves your body, there's no longer the strife, a wishing down a well that lives in your mind. When you can't see the demon, fate approaches behind. So here I remain, left of my searching. As the years pass by, my choices keep working. Yet to stance, this chance, it can't go on for long. The throng, the sound, my ears, they pound. It yells, it tells a story that's gory and strange and weird. But we're here to give, to take. It's never too late to be great or even just better by writing a poem, a song, or your sweet love in a letter, but it's the changing of seasons that gives us the reasons to avoid the worst of all treason, which is tragedy. So glad to be alive, go thrive and strive to rise, to be your best above the rest. But a thing that stings in my thoughts as I'm caught in this web with a spider, this fictional writer who pens my fate with poison and apples that fell from a tree near me. I'm tempted to see, so I bite, I eat, like Adam, like Eve. When it rains, it pours, they grow, we sow, we know. These sores on the fruit, they spread, they suit my thoughts of the past that last forever, haunting, daunting, stealing my mind, standing there wishing I could leave it behind for a bed and a thread of hope, for power and hours of sleep. But I rise, I wake, I take, I look, I sneak a peek at a freak. Oh my good Lord, who is this creep? Why do I look at my image and weep? Allow me the beauty, let it be clearer. What the hell is this monster looking back in the mirror? The horror, its complexion, all I can see is some terrible reflection of an attempted perfection. It comes apart into sections and begs the simple, profound, particular question: who am I? And why have you left me alone in this place? Nobody comes when I cry. All around me, I'm surrounded by this enormous veil. A transparent tent that confines me. I can't get out. I'm trapped. Nobody is ever coming to save me. I can't breathe in this place. Where is my mother? Where is our mother? More importantly, why does that question render silence as its only answer? Why are we forced to suffer the vast darkness of eternity in total ignorance? I don't know, but I can tell you this for sure. If we continue to seek the light, humanity will eventually learn the truth. In the meantime, and for better or worse, this is who we are. This is our journey. You, me, even Scott Peterson.